This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During this holiday week, we're featuring a retrospective of some of our more entertaining interviews of the year. I spoke with Steve Carell in October. Carell was a correspondent for The Daily Show from 1999 to 2004. Then he really hit it big, starring in The 40-Year-Old Virgin. He's nominated for a Golden Globe for his starring role in NBC's hit series The Office. Carell plays Michael Scott, the boss in the Schenectady branch of the Dunder Mifflin Paper Supply Company. He thinks he's an enlightened, empathetic, and witty manager, but he's clueless about how to deal with people. As for his jokes, they're usually pretty tasteless. The Office is shot in the form of a mockumentary. Here's a scene from one of the classic episodes. In the opening scene, Michael is defending himself after the human resources director has reprimanded him for something he said to Oscar, one of the company employees. After we hear that part, we'll hear Michael directly addressing the camera, explaining himself.
No, that is the fun of this place. I call everybody faggy. Why would anyone find that offensive?
Okay, I think Oscar would just like if he's lame or something like that.
That's what faggy means.
No, not really.
Oh.
Apparently you called Oscar faggy.
Yeah.
For, like, the movie Shakespeare in Love more than an action movie.
It wasn't just an action movie. It was Die Hard.
All right, Michael, but... Oscar's really gay.
Exactly.
I mean, for real.
Yeah, I know.
No, he's attracted to other men.
Okay, a little too far, cross the line.
Okay, I am telling you, Oscar is an actual homosexual. Yeah, he told me this morning, and obviously he hopes he can count on your discretion.
I would have never called him that if I knew. You don't call retarded people retards. It's bad taste. You call your friends retards when they're acting retarded. And I consider Oscar a friend.
Steve Carell, when you got that script, did you think, like, oh, this is so perfect?
It, you know what? That's one of my favorite lines, that we call talking heads when we're actually addressing the camera. Because that, I think, sums up his character. He's not trying to hurt anyone. He just doesn't understand.
A lot of people who have worked in offices feel like they've worked with somebody like Michael Scott, but you've never worked in offices. It's just, you know, you're an actor. So who do you draw on for the character? Are there teachers that you had or other people who you knew who were
primarily
as clueless?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I think for me it stemmed mostly from various teachers that I had growing up, because many teachers that I've had, especially 5th, 6th, 7th grade, would be people who were trying to be as cool as the students or wanted the students to think that they were cool, but indeed they were not. And the harder they tried, the less cool they would appear to be. And that's basically what Michael is up against. He thinks people think he's cool. He thinks people like him and think he's funny and charming, but he's really none of those things. And incidentally, when you say everyone knows a Michael Scott, I guess the rule of thumb, Ricky Gervais told me this in regards to the character that he played, David Brent, in the BBC version of The Office, is that if you don't know a Michael Scott, then you are Michael Scott.
That's really great.
So better that you actually have a frame of reference for a Michael Scott.
Let me move on to 40-Year-Old Virgin, which you co-wrote. How did the idea get started for the film? Were you in on the very start of it?
Well, I pitched the idea to Judd.
Oh.
We worked together. He was one of the producers on Anchorman, in which I played one of Will Ferrell's less intelligent compadres. And Judd asked me at the end of shooting if I had any ideas for movie sort of things. And I had a meeting with him, and I just pitched this idea. It's something I'd been kicking around for a while. I didn't have a script in place. But the seed of the idea, the notion was, and this is what I pitched to him, was a guy at a poker game with a bunch of other guys that he might not know very well. And everyone is, all the guys are regaling each other with these tales of conquest and women. And the conversation turns to him, and it's his time to step up and tell a story. And he has no frame of reference. He has no, he can't speak this language that these other guys are speaking. And so he tries unsuccessfully to tell a tale of his own sexual conquest of a woman. And he just fails miserably. And that is when he is essentially outed, that he doesn't know what he's talking about and that he's a virgin. And Judd really liked the idea. And from there, he actually said, as soon as I pitched it to him, he looked at me and he said, I could call Universal right now and we could sell that idea this afternoon. And literally 3 days later, he was working with somebody from Universal. He casually mentioned the idea and they bought it right then and there. They just said, you go and write it and we'll pay for that.
I guess, like, you know, since the premise of the movie when you came up with the idea was about listening to these sexual exploits and having like nothing to say that could measure up to that.
Yeah.
Had you been exposed to a lot of those kind of sexual bragging type of stories when you were in high school?
Oh, sure. When any group of young testosterone-riddled males get together, those stories are kind of inevitable, I think. And I always thought it would be funny if one person just could not keep up, and not only not keep up, but truly put his foot in it. In the movie, the character talks about feeling a woman's breasts, and he explains that they felt like a bag of sand. And clearly, this is not someone who has any experience. And to me, what was funny was not so much the story, but how the other characters were reacting to the story. It's like that there's a scene in which I get chest waxed, and I chose to actually get waxed for the movie because I thought it would be funny. And I thought not so much the fact that I'm being waxed is what's funny, at least to me, but the reaction that and a very natural reaction at that the other guys in the scene will have while I'm being waxed. Because that to me, you can't act. If a buddy of yours is having their chest hair waxed in front of you, you will react a certain way and you'll capture something. And to me, that was the funniest part of the scene. These guys just cringing and laughing their heads off.
Well, let's hear the beginning of the chest waxing scene, and then we'll talk about how you reacted when your chest hair was really waxed. Here it comes.
So, ready?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3.
Oh, you I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's just your job,
you
huh?
Just stop now?
No. That's okay. Let's do another.
That one little patch looks sexy, though.
Does it look good?
Yeah, it looks really good.
Ooh.
It looks man-tastic.
I love how you're trying to be so nice. Oh, it's just your job.
So, oh,
were you prepared?
That was the worst day.
Yeah,
ever.
How much did it really hurt, and were you prepared for it?
It hurt so much. And frankly, all of the women on the crew who had experienced waxing in their lives were each one of them came up to me individually and they said things like, well, aren't you sure you don't want to trim your hair back a little bit? Or would you like to take some Advil? just anything to kind of ease the pain. And of course, I thought, no, I want it to really hurt. It won't play unless it really hurts badly. And the woman who was waxing my chest wasn't, in fact, an actual chest waxer or a professional waxer. She was an actress who listed that as one of her special abilities, which, as we all know, are usually lies. So she was just this side of proficient at it. And if you look closely on one take, you can see the blood.
Oh, I know.
Sort of bubbling to the surface. It really hurt. It hurt. And the hardest part was just continuing with it, because after that first rip, I knew that we had a lot more scene to go. And it didn't dawn on me. You know, I went in that morning, I thought, oh, this will be fun. And they'd set up 6 cameras because obviously we could only do one take of it. And then as she spread that hot wax on that first strip, I thought, this truly might have been a mistake. This might not end well for anybody. But I'm glad I did it.
What ground rules did you give yourself for, like, how much to curse or how much to scream?
Well, my idea behind it was to scream all sorts of different types of obscenities, from Kelly Clarkson to, you know, to the more generic swearing. But that underneath, as you pointed out, I apologize to her and say, well, I know you're just doing your job. So I figured he's a nice guy, but even nice people pushed to those limits can lash out. And in the face of that kind of pain, can drop that sort of veneer of niceness, which is interesting, too, because I thought, you know, just character-wise, that's what Judd and I wanted to do, that not to draw a picture of just a purely nice, innocent, wonderful, sweet guy. He had problems. He was just a guy. He wasn't like – there's a lot of gray area to a character like that. And rather than kind of paint him as a sort of a stereotype, we wanted him to be a bit more realistic, I guess.
So just getting back to that chest waxing scene one more time, did you end it prematurely because it hurt so much, or was the character supposed to walk out with his chest half done when he does?
The character was supposed to walk out. As soon as she got to the smiley face, or as Paul Rudd deemed it, a man-o-lantern, then at that point was when I was supposed to get up and leave. And believe me, I had plenty. I was done.
So what happened to your real chest hair that was left afterwards? Because, you know, you leave in a state where you have some of your hair, it's your half denuded of hair and half hairy.
Much to my wife's chagrin, it was left as is. Uh-huh. And she – I wore a T-shirt for months after that. I could not expose my chest to anyone. It was really horrifying looking. And then when it grows back in, that is a mess. That is just ingrown hair festival. It is not anything I would ever recommend that someone do.
My guest is Steve Carell. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Steve Carell. He stars in the NBC series The Office, starred in the movies The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Dan in Real Life, and Evan Almighty, and co-starred in Little Miss Sunshine. Now, before you started making movies, you were on The Daily Show. And you started, I think, just before Jon Stewart got there and continued till, was it 2003, 2002?
Right around there. I was there for about 3.5 years.
Well, you were certainly there in part of 2003 because you were there at the start of the invasion.
Yes.
So how did you get on The Daily Show?
Stephen Colbert got me the job. I owe it all to him. We'd worked together at Second City, and then when they were looking for new correspondents, Stephen threw my name in the hat. And they called, and they essentially gave me an audition. But I owe him that job.
So what was your audition for The Daily Show?
Well, what they do, instead of a set audition, they send you out on a field piece. And my audition field piece was interviewing a man in Colorado who believed that Walt Disney had a subterranean lair built at Disneyland in which he would kidnap children and make them into mind control slaves. So that was my first – that was my first Daily Show piece.
Was this a real guy who really believed that?
It was truly, and I almost didn't take the job because of this. Because essentially, the Daily Show back then was a bit meaner than it is today. It would go after extremely eccentric people who, for no fault of their own, believed we're just quirky. We're
mentally ill.
Yeah, I mean, yes. To put a fine point on it, they were. And to go out and to mock these people and to do a story about how crazy they are. This guy was mentally ill, and I felt terrible because really we weren't making any sort of point. We were just mocking the fact that he believed what he believed. over the next several months, and you know, when John came on, the tone changed dramatically. And I almost didn't take the job. The only way, and I talked to Stephen about this too, and asked him how, because he's a very kind, gentle guy. And I said, how can you do it? You know, how can you rationalize this? Because it's just so mean, and it's like shooting fish in a barrel. It's just these people can't fight back. And what I decided to do was to sort of assume the character of a boob, of an idiot. And the more ridiculous I was in the interviews, the dumber the questions that I asked, the more they would react to that. The more it sort of took the focus off the subject, and I became the idiot. So the audience was laughing at what an idiot and jerk I was, as opposed to the people I was interviewing, and I felt kind of let them off the hook. But otherwise, it was a very hard thing for me to rationalize.
Did the Disney piece make it on the air?
Oh yeah, yeah. That went on. They wasted nothing. Here's the other side of it, though. There were people that we interviewed who deserved it, who really deserved to be taken to task. You know, Stephen. Went somewhere down south and had this run-in with skinheads and the neo-Nazi groups, and that's a different thing. I mean, that's going after, you know, people of intolerance or people who deserve it, essentially. That I had no problem with at all, but it was those innocent, quirky, frankly unstable people that was never fun, and it was always a trick to try to turn the joke on myself and away from them.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Acton, Massachusetts.
And tell me something about your neighborhood.
We lived in a brown Garrison colonial. And my dad was an engineer. My mom was a psychiatric nurse. It was a pretty normal little town. I played with my friends in the neighborhood. We had something called Demolition Derby. We lived sort of at the bottom of a hill, and kids would build essentially soapbox kind of cars, and we would have races, but mostly it was to try to destroy each other's cars on the way down. So that's why we called it Demolition Derby. It was pretty normal. I wouldn't say bucolic Rockwell childhood, but it was a fairly normal upbringing with the youth hockey and the youth baseball and all of those things. I have three older brothers, and I was able to antagonize them as much as I could.
The hockey and the baseball and the Demolition Derby, and where did the theater come in? Where did acting come in?
That was just that was just for fun. That was always a hobby for me. It's nothing I ever thought would end up being a career. And really through college, it was just something I did on the side and just something that I always enjoyed doing, but I never thought it was a viable career choice.
You thought your career was going to be law, right? You were about to apply to law school?
Yeah, that was the plan. And I think ultimately I was planning on doing that because I thought my parents sent me to a private school the next town over. And I think they were not wealthy people by any means. And I think I felt obligated to pay them back somehow by making something of myself, because they had really worked very hard to send me to this great school. And so I sort of started thinking about law and that might be a good fit for me. And it came to filling out the applications, and the essay question asked why I wanted to be an attorney. And I just could not respond to that. I had no idea, other than that it sounded good, that it's something that I figured would make them happy. And I talked to them about it, and they were the ones who said I should try acting. They were the ones who said, this is something you've always liked to do. You should try it. You should at least give it a shot, because it's something you've always just had fun at, and that's what your life should be. It should just be doing something that you enjoy.
So when you decided that you would do that, that you would pursue acting, what did you see for yourself?
My goal as an actor was to just make a living. That was all. And by 1988 is the last year that I waited tables to supplement my income. And that's when I was able to just start acting exclusively and supporting myself. And that to me was – that was the line that I was able to cross. And that was my line of success. That was it for me. If anything beyond that was icing on the cake.
It's been great to talk with you. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Steve Carell recorded last October. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.